The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Wow, it's great to see everybody, especially a little bit closer now that we've pulled our chairs up. So, this week, I am working with a lung infection that has lingered for a long time, and so I find that, first of all, I may cough a bit during this talk, but also I'm finding it's really sapping my energy level, and so I have to think about, will I have enough energy to do everything I would like to do today? And that got me thinking about the topic of what is really reliable in our life. And so I thought to talk tonight about the refuges of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And kind of, I hope, give a way of linking them together and maybe some ideas for you about how you can think about these in your own life. Because I think these really come alive when we know for ourselves what these particular terms refer to in our own life and our own practice. But let me start with this verse from the Dhammapada. People threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is a supreme refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path leading to the end of all suffering, then this is the secure refuge. This is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So there's a comparison between refuges like mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines, and the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I think the first one refers, you know, to the various external places that we try to go for refuge. It may not, sometimes it's literally to the mountain or the forest, but, you know, it could be to our home, our car, our job, these kinds of things. Actually, refuge is common to all strands of Buddhism. It's a very fundamental thing shared across many different traditions. So I also pulled out this verse that's from a Tibetan teaching that's been put in modern English. Locked up in the prison of their own patterning, whom can ordinary gods protect? Who can you count on for refuge? Go for refuge in the three jewels. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So this one uses the term ordinary gods to refer to the refuges that we choose. We're always choosing something, whether it's power, pleasure, health, our body, wealth, relationship, learning, physical safety, moral purity, even meditative bliss, people use as refuges. And these become gods if we make them such, you know, if we pursue them and buy into the view that these are things that will bring us ultimate happiness. It's not that they don't bring us any happiness, and it's not that they're not at all worth pursuing or developing in our lives in order to have a rich human life. But the question is, do they protect us in the same way that these other alternatives, the three jewels, which are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha? So both of these quotes, widely separated in time, widely separated in tradition that they're linked to, say that the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are the reliable refuge. But what does this really mean? So we're going to look at this. So we'll start with refuge in the Buddha. This can refer to the actual historical Buddha. There are verses that point toward revering this person as, you know, the one who found the path for us. I think more commonly in the modern era, we talk about refuge in the awakening of the Buddha, having faith in that. But the Buddha himself, you know, provides an example. And there's classic language from the written teachings. I'll just give one version of it. Excellent, excellent. It is as if a man were to set upright that which was overturned, or were to reveal that which was hidden, or were to point out the way to one who had gone astray, or were to hold a lamp amidst the darkness so that those who have eyes may see. Even so has the doctrine been explained in various ways by the Exalted One. May the Exalted One, which is the Buddha, remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. So this may sound a little dramatic to us in the modern world, but this is what people were said to have said when actually in his presence. You know, so they were in the presence of the Buddha. He gave them a teaching of some kind, and it made so much sense that they were moved to offer this exaltation, in a sense. And it's maybe worth noting that the Buddha does not ask people to go for refuge in him. It's not induced or somehow required or said you should do this in order to become a Buddhist. These were spontaneous sayings by people who were moved by his teachings. Now, we don't actually have the physical presence of the Buddha anymore. It's understood that that body has died, like all human bodies do, and we have, you know, we have his memory and we have his teachings. So it might be worth noting also that when the Buddha died, he explicitly said for people to take refuge in two things: themselves and the Dhamma. That was what he offered. So here, for example, monks or practitioners, be islands unto yourself, be your own refuge, having no other. Let the Dhamma be an island and a refuge to you, having no other. Those who are islands unto themselves should investigate to the very heart of things. What is the source of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair? How do they arise? So this is an instruction along with this idea of taking refuge. So it's interesting, right, that he points the finger back to our own heart and to the teachings that we'll practice, but we'll get to refuge in the Dhamma in a moment. So he doesn't say, remember me as your refuge as I'm dying, you know, always honor me, always serve me. It's about finding something in yourself. You know, I've been a model for you, I've taught you, now it's your turn, in a sense. And that comes with investigating the source of suffering, with the complete confidence that he's saying is that you can find this. You can do it now. You can find the source of suffering and find the end of it in your life. So we might say then that refuge in the Buddha points toward what is in us that allows us to see, that allows us to find our way, that allows us to know what is upright and what isn't. As the quote said earlier, oh, it's just as if someone were to set something upright. Well, what is it in you that knows that when you are practicing in your life, when you're making decisions, when you're considering how to go forward? We have something inside of us that guides us, not perfectly until we're arahants, but can we have some confidence in that and some trust in that? So epithets of the Buddha include this one, which I've always liked a lot. Unexcelled trainer of those who wish to be trained, or other translations say unexcelled trainer of those fit to be trained. It's a little different, but so this is, you know, kind of the horse training model, I guess. But nonetheless, I like it because there's nothing coercive in it. I especially like trainer of those who wish to be trained. So we've stepped forward and said, train me. You know, that is what we offer when we come and put ourselves on the cushion, for example, or come and listen to a teacher. And within ourselves, then, we can proceed in the same way, right? We have some kind of a guide that helps us know what is upright, helps us to find our way, and we choose somehow to follow that. And it's not coercive, it's not bring out the whip and, you know, you got to do it this way and so forth. But we proceed in a gentle way and we work with the part of ourselves that wishes to be trained. So I've found this useful in my own path, is that there's something in me that, of course, there's a million things about myself, if I'm thinking in that way, that I want to change. But the question as we go down the path is, what is wishing, you know, what is wishing to be trained? What is the next thing that's up that's saying, pay some attention to me, or here's a source of suffering? And we work with that. So we become our own Buddha, our own trainer of that part of ourselves that wishes to be trained. And maybe then something else comes forth later. And this provides a sense of having an inner direction, having an inner compass. Now, that's a very pragmatic view, very in the moment. It's also possible to see the Buddha as a refuge, as an ideal. We do need some kind of North Star to navigate. How could we go traveling without some idea of the destination? Otherwise, it's just random wandering, if you will. So the Buddha can also hold the place of our aspiration or our noble wishes for ourselves and our lives. And it's meant to be that in a supportive way, not in a constricting way. It's definitely easy for the mind to over-idealize and then start beating ourselves up for not matching that. So watch your mind as it relates to ideals. But I see these two sides of the refuge in the Buddha. The very practical, what is it that I know is true and need to navigate right now? And also some kind of a North Star that I may or may not ever reach, but that is a larger guide for the path. So let's go back to this quote about what the Buddha wished for people to take refuge in. The second part was, let the Dhamma be an island and a refuge to you, having no other. And then those who are islands unto themselves should investigate, what is the source of sorrow? What is the source of suffering? So the word Dhamma or Dharma is an interesting word. It has a lot of different meanings. And I think for the refuge, several of them are relevant. The first meaning of the word Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha. So that sometimes the teachings are called the Buddha Dharma, what he offered. It's so helpful to have key teachings in one's mind because we're going to encounter difficulties. I can't tell you the number of times that something has happened and something springs to mind. You know, maybe that I had read years ago or that I heard a Dharma talk recently or something. And, you know, this is an important reason to listen to the Dharma and to read books and also to meditate, so that our mind is ready to encounter things in the world, and then maybe some key teaching will come up. Actually, there's a sutta where somebody asked the Buddha, why is it that sometimes teachings spring into my mind that I haven't even memorized? And then he says, and sometimes teachings don't spring into my mind, even when I've worked really hard to memorize them. And the Buddha says the difference is mindfulness. Is that, you know, if you were paying attention, then, you know, while doing that, then they would stick in your mind and, you know, enter into your heart. So, just as one small example, there was a period in my life when I used the phrase, what would I have to let go of to make this easier? And it was interesting because I found that whenever I was struggling with something or frustrated by something or unsure about something, I could use that phrase, what would I have to let go of to make this easier? And often it was kind of clear, you know. It's like I knew in some level what was sticking in my heart there. So it's kind of a practice phrase that I used walking around. So I recommend finding phrases like that. I don't know if that particular one is the right one for you, but you can find something that just by determining for yourself, oh, this is interesting and useful to me, you can call it to mind at moments when you're feeling like you need a little bit of extra support. Another example is that there was a time a number of years ago when my car radio was stolen out of my car while my car was parked in its own carport, by the way. And, of course, I was annoyed by this or surprised or something. There was an initial reaction. But one of the first things also that arose in my mind was compassion for the thief, actually, that they would think this was going to be good for them to have that radio and to it was worth breaking into the car to do that. So I was grateful at that moment for the teachings that was one of the first things that came to mind was to think about the welfare of the person who had just done this. That's not going to be good for them in the long run, maybe not even in the short run. And also, another one of the thoughts that came into my mind when that happened was the transience of things. It's like, oh, at first I was annoyed my radio was stolen. And then I thought, well, it's not my radio anymore. Sort of by definition, it's not. And so then I thought, right, you know, these things are not really mine. These things pass along. So, again, we can be grateful that we've heard teachings. And that was way better than spinning in anger for hours or days or something. That just wouldn't have been as good for me, right? And it didn't change the situation at all. That had already happened. But my mind was in a better state because of having those teachings available. So studying and learning the principles of things like karma, generosity, virtue, and wisdom are really, really helpful, not only just through the practice of doing that and sort of reorienting one's mind, but in those moments where those teachings are going to come forward as a refuge for the mind that could otherwise go somewhere else that was harmful, but no, it has somewhere safe to go instead, thoughts and feelings that are more beneficial for it. So this is kind of a segue then into a second meaning of the term dharma, which is nature, how things are, how things are. So Uttejaniya, actually, a Burmese teacher, uses as one of his practice phrases or teaches that we can use, this is nature, this is nature, as something to work with. And that's usually offered at times when the mind is reactive. And so we're caught in anger or we're caught in sadness or depression and we know it. And we have enough mindfulness to be able to see, wow, I'm really down right now or I'm really upset or I'm really afraid. But we don't quite have the strength of awareness to banish that state. So we're sort of living with it at that time. But for that time, we can also bring in the reflection, this is nature. This is happening not because I'm a bad person, not because of that other person that I'm blaming. It's actually happening because the causes and conditions for fear are here right now. And if they weren't, it wouldn't be here. And so, you know, we can just reflect, this is how it is right now. And this is, again, a refuge. So with this understanding, we don't have to worry about pleasant things going away. Something else will arise. We don't have to worry about unpleasant things appearing. They won't last forever. How are things? They're changing. That's how they are. And so we bring in this very deep understanding of the Dharma, that things are changing, they're transitory, always flowing. They are not a source of eternal happiness. That's part of why Dharma is a better refuge. It's better to take refuge in how things are than to take refuge in the things. Because the things are ultimately unsatisfactory. And it's also helpful that to notice that things are pretty impersonal. You know, it's not that it's all about you and, you know, my own challenges. Of course they're my challenges and not anybody else's challenges. But they're arising because the conditions for them are there. Sometimes that one works. Another common expression of refuge in the Dharma is to see things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. So what does that mean? It means it's a way of seeing that's helpful in all the cases I've found that I could remember to do it, is to identify what's happening. Is this suffering? What's happening? Is there some stress here? Are we looking at somehow the cause of suffering? You know, is there some kind of clinging or craving happening? That's a little bit, what would I have to let go of to make this easier? That's turning the mind toward what's the source. So this is the second noble truth. What is the cause? What am I clinging to? What am I craving that is causing my mind to be so tight and upset right now? But it's not all about the suffering. You can also notice in a moment, where's the freedom right now? What's open? What's peaceful about what's happening? What's good about what's happening? Where's the liberation in this moment? And sometimes that's readily available. Often we just forget to ask that question. We're so interested in what's wrong, what's potentially harmful about what's happening, that we actually forget to ask what's liberating about what's happening right now. And that's a really nice reflection to train the mind to do. Or it could be that what we're working with is part of the path. You know, we're developing metta at this moment. Oh, metta's part of the path. Or we're developing patience. Ah, I feel the patience arising. Yes, this is a stressful moment, but I'm focusing on the patience. Well, that's part of the path. And then you understand, okay, I'm developing the mind at this moment. So you see there are these different angles and aspects that we can look at and experience. And if they relate to these truths which point toward the path of liberation, that's helpful because then we're reinforcing our practice right through what's happening in this moment. And there's nowhere else to do the practice but this moment. So bringing the Dharma in through the reflections on the Four Noble Truths is really, really helpful. And I find that when I do these reflections and when I am connected with how the Dharma is relating to what's unfolding in this moment, what arises for me is trust in the process, which is my understanding of refuge in the Dharma. So I don't know where the next moment is going to go. I don't know at all how my path is unfolding. But I know that I can trust this process to move me toward situations and places and understandings that will open my mind, open my heart, and bring benefit. And I have a very deep trust of that, even when there are rough spots and dry spots and challenging spots on the path. The subtitle of Sharon Salzberg's book, which is called Faith, is Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience. I love this because this is the art, really the art of refuge, is to know what your own deepest experience is, not what you read about the Buddha did, not what somebody told you in a Dharma talk, but what is your own deepest experience, and do you trust that? Do you trust that as a basis for your life, as a guidepost for making the next decision? Can I really trust my own deepest understanding when there's no genuine confirmation of it from regular society? You know, that's what's being asked of us. And it's a process. So I feel like walking the path means learning to live from this place, which definitely takes practice. So how can I stay in touch with that deep freedom inside and still live in the world? So one way we do that is through the Sangha, the third of the refuges. In a Theravadan chant, the Sangha is said to be born of the Dhamma, which I think is lovely. It points toward the Sangha as an emergent quality of a world where the Dhamma is taught. Then there's going to be a Sangha. So one way to think about the Sangha is to consider that it serves the function of being the guides on our path. So we have a spiritual ideal in the Buddha, or we have our own heart, and we have a way or a method through the teachings, the Dhamma. But to walk that way, we're going to need guides. Maybe there are other people that are walking also, but there's somebody who can help guide us along the way. These guides are most often literally people. So people who share our intentions, our practice, and our path. It's common here in the West to call our spiritual groups sanghas because we're doing this together. And in that sense, in this sense of other people who are sharing our practice with us, I think there are two different ways that this can manifest in the Sangha. So one is support for going against the stream. Like I talked about, you know, can we trust our own deepest experience even when there's no confirmation of it from regular society? Well, luckily, there are some people who will help to support what we're doing. Definitely what we do is not supported by ads, movies, magazines, TV, or other aspects of popular culture, mostly. So we need to be with people who help us remember that this way of living is worthwhile sometimes. You know, just by existing somehow, other practitioners passively assure us that we're doing the right thing to meditate, to cultivate ethics and other good behaviors. I remember hearing once that, and I've actually heard this from other people, is that there are people in the world who have no intention ever of, for example, going on a meditation retreat, but they're totally inspired to know that people do that. You know, it's like, so when I used to live at Insight Retreat Center, and I told people, sometimes I would tell people that that's what I did, and they say, oh, I think that's so great. You know, I just love that there are these retreats. I could never be silent for that long. That's often people's first reaction. But you could tell that they were kind of excited that this center existed near their city and that there were people doing this regularly. They were sort of awed by this. And so in a strange way, this is kind of support for others. You know, just, and so even the fact that we're in here meditating, there are people who can't quite get here. You know, they like the idea of meditation, but the fact that people would actually come and do that for an hour and a half on a Thursday night, that's really inspiring to them. Yeah. So that's one way that the Sangha functions. In a more active sense, other practitioners can help us when things get rough. So there are points on the path that are kind of dry and boring, and there are parts that are where we're working through something that are challenging. And it's not that easy to talk about these things with people who don't practice sometimes. It can be fine, but sometimes it's nice just to speak with someone else who's like, yeah, I know, you know, I know it's like that. They can understand that language. Now, a second major way that the Sangha of fellow practitioners works is sometimes a little less pleasant than those two, but really also useful, which is that they are a mirror that allow us to see our behavior patterns, especially the unskillful ones. Yeah? I see a few people nodding. So quite reliably, other practitioners can help us to see the parts of ourselves that we're not quite seeing. We all know we have those parts. And, you know, areas where we're clinging, where we're judgmental, certainly where we're getting our buttons pushed, you know. sometimes that can happen, and we can see that really mirrored very easily through other practitioners. So this is another, another case study, is that when I was living at IRC, we were beginning to form a small insight community down there, a small community of lay practitioners. And at first, when I moved in, actually, there were only two of us there, and we were living in different buildings, so there wasn't, that much interaction or community in that sense. But by the time I left, I think we had seven people or something, many of them living in kind of a small area near each other. And, I won't go into any specifics, but for sure we started to bump up against each other and find out, what are that person's pet peeves and to what degree should I accommodate them and to what degree should I say, we should really talk about this. can we have some wise speech about this? And it's a real practice to be in a spiritual community and to start to, and in the same way for me, I saw my own pet peeves, just trying to share a kitchen with four other people or something. And then I have to look at myself, what am I clinging to here and what am I judgmental about? I learned a few things about myself, yeah. So there are different kinds and qualities of these guides that we're going to meet on the path. And, I think in many ways all fellow practitioners are, and we're going to make use of many guides along our path. And perhaps, too, we'll help someone else at some point. We may be the guide already, or we'll have that opportunity in the future, kind of a pay-it-forward system. But I think for the purposes of this teaching, it is worth noting that there are two kinds of sangha that are mentioned in the Pali Canon, in the written teachings. So most traditionally and conservatively in our tradition, sangha refers specifically to people who have seen something of the truth that the Buddha points to. And these are called noble ones or Aryas. You'll hear that word. So this is the Arya Sangha. And in this sense, in that sense, the Sangha didn't exist right away, right? Because the Buddha was enlightened and he was the only person who understood what he understood. And then he began to teach. In particular, he went and taught five people that he used to practice with. And at the end of his first sermon, one of them reached the first stage of awakening, just barely. And that was the moment when the Sangha was created. In a sense, the teachings have been transmitted. So this is why the Sangha is born of the Dharma. It's born from the teaching of the truths. And it became transmitted, and then there were, more and more. So that's one kind of, that's one way to see what the word Sangha refers to traditionally, and that this is considered a very reliable refuge as people who have received in a long chain since then the teachings of the Buddha. And then the other Sangha that's referred to is the monastic Sangha, or the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni Sangha, which are people who have ordained in a Buddhist lineage. And they're not necessarily all people who have seen the truth that the Buddha was teaching, but they're supposed to be kind of the representatives of that. And so, again, the idea is that at some stage in your practice, this Sangha may be useful. I know for myself that I see something in somebody who's in robes. There's something to me that's visually meaningful to see someone who has committed their life that way. And I'm surprised by that because I'm not normally, that's not a kind of a something that I grew up with, or it doesn't fit other qualities of my personality necessarily, but I can't deny that when I see the red robe, something changes in me and I feel something for that. So I urge you to check it out for yourself if you think you might be surprised to discover something in yourself. So these are offered. I offer these different aspects or definitions of Sangha so that you can feel for yourself, what kind of guides feel appropriate to me, and it'll probably change at different stages of your practice. You'll begin to get a feel for yourself who is a good guide for you at a certain time. The Sangha is said to be, again in a Theravadan chant, an incomparable field of merit for the world, which I think is a lovely phrase. What does it mean? So one side of this is maybe the traditional understanding is that it said that giving to the Sangha, and in particular the Arya Sangha, brings great benefit. But thinking in terms of making merit is not usually what we do in the West. So it might be nice to think of this phrase as referring to our own actions within the larger community. You know, this field of merit is something that we start to participate in. As we develop in practice, we become more compassionate, more wise. And so we can act in beneficial ways for the world and for those around us. So we become more skillful in friendliness, in kindness, in generosity, in expressing wisdom. You know, I think many of us know people like this who are just always looking out for the harmony of the group, always offering some little thing, always finding a way to bring people together. We need more people in the world who act this way. And this is the field of merit that we share if we choose to then participate in this and continue that. It can really generate some sort of a positive feedback loop of good behavior. In some ways, the IMC community represents something of this. It's donation-based, and people come, and I see people just offering the best of themselves in so many ways here, in quite a non-coercive way. So we're field of merit here. I think at some point in our practice, we become able to learn in many, many ways. So we can have many different guides. Our understanding of the refuges deepens over time. Now, we've talked about Sangha up to now on the literal level of people or beings. Certainly we can learn from our dog also, right? I would think. But at some level, we may find that people and beings don't exist in such a solid way. And then we can ask, what does Sangha refer to at a level like that? Is it not relevant or something? There are other ways of seeing it. So more broadly, I think we can learn to make use of experience itself as our guide on the path. So we can relate to all of our experience without grasping, pushing it away, or ignoring it. And in that moment, you know, moments like that, we're taking refuge in the guides that are offered to us just through what's arising. You know, oh, anger is arising. That's my guide. How do I relate to that? Oh, you know, excitement is arising. That's my guide at this moment. Am I going to leap on that train and go? Am I going to be mindful of it and just enjoy it? Am I going to push it away? Oh, excitement. I'm a spiritual person. I'm not excited now. You know, how do we relate to that? So that becomes our Sangha, is the cluster of experiences that flow with us through life. I think this is a deeper experience of Sangha, of the communion of our own being. The body and the mind that we're living with each moment can be our Sangha. There's a Zen teaching, very pithy, that is three questions and answers. I'll read them. Master, yes. Pay attention, yes, I will. Don't be fooled by others, no, I won't. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Master, yes. Pay attention. Yes, I will. Don't be fooled by others. No, I won't. So I hope for all of you, you can find in yourself something from this talk, from teachings you've heard, from readings, that you'll maybe take a moment to reflect for yourself what these refuges mean for you and how they function in your life. Maybe most importantly, how they can be refuges so that we're not resorting to parks, trees, shrines, and ordinary gods of the world as our supreme refuge. We'll still deal with those things, but we understand at some level that something else is a more reliable support for us. So thank you. And I'd be happy to take questions or comments. I'd love to hear what other people consider to be refuge or anything else you want to share. Could you wait for the microphone?
I just wanted to say I liked the part in your talk where you talked about when you were caught in something, having the question, where's the freedom here? Because mm-hmm. almost by definition, when I'm caught in something, that's the last question I would think of.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
Thank you, Kim, for this talk. This is a new idea for me to think about cluster of experiences as a sangha. That's kind of nice, you know, that they can be companions and they can be helpers. And I don't know, that's kind of a new idea. I like it. Thank you.
Maureen.
I was really impressed by your quoting Sharon Salzberg, trusting your own deepest experience. I thought that was a really succinct way to put it. There's so many cultural trappings in Buddhism that it's like sometimes I'll find myself being confused by the cultural trappings. But when you get it down to something as simple as paying attention and taking responsibility for yourself and trusting your deepest experience, it's like, oh, I can relate to that so easily. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, Sharon captured it nicely. It's a good book, actually, that book, Faith. Yeah. All right, good. Well, thank you, everyone, for your practice.